The sermon scripture for this morning is from Romans chapter 12, verses 9 through 16. Let love be genuine. Hate what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with mutual affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Do not lag in zeal. Be ardent in spirit. Serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope. Be patient in suffering, persevere in prayer. Contribute to the needs of the saints. Extend hospitality to strangers. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Do not claim to be wiser than you are. First, let me say that the sermon title in the bulletin has nothing to do with this sermon. As I was casting about for what to say this morning, I had two ideas in mind. That title goes with another sermon for another time. And I also want to say thank you to Margie. At my request, she sang that song from South Pacific. First Broadway show I ever went to when I was 10. And I'm sure that those words had not nearly the impact on me then that they do now. As an avid reader, I am frequently drawn to books, stacks of books at the bookstore, book reviews in the New York Times, book titles that pop up on Amazon. This book I am discussing this morning leapt off the inside front cover of Harper's Magazine, and I ordered it immediately. It's not a big book, and I'm happy to share it with anyone who would like to read it in more detail. The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide for Repairing Our Humanity by Sally Cohn. She was a commentator on Fox News for 2 years and is now on CNN. She has a reputation as a fierce progressive, able to talk with people who have diametrically opposite views with respect and empathy. Her point of view is that while some see hate as a useful tool, she believes it is more likely that she can have an influence if people actually listen, which they won't do if they think she hates them. So how widespread is hate? Consciously? Unconsciously, probably very different levels. All of us, in one way or another, sometimes consider other individuals and entire groups of human beings as though they are fundamentally less deserving than we are. Well, with the possible exception of Mr. Rogers. Ms. Cohn has done a massive amount of research to ferret out a pyramid of hate, from stereotyping to the belief in inherent superiority of some groups to individual acts of prejudice like bullying to institutional forms of discrimination to bias-motivated violence to genocide. Our history is littered with hate from the earliest days of the Puritans, so beset with meeting some strict Old Testament concepts of rules and righteousness that they turned on their own neighbors, to the annihilation of American Indians, to the enslavement of Africans. Here we are in the 21st century, and we're still not far from deep currents of hate. Cohn's research leads her to the idea of fundamental attribution errors. This is our tendency to believe that when someone else does something hurtful, that person is hurtful. But when we do something hurtful, it's because our action was justified by some situation or context. This concept first emerged out of a 1967 study on political attitudes about Fidel Castro, whether responders to a test were pro-Castro or anti-Castro, and it has been confirmed in many subsequent studies. The same effect is magnified in our prejudices against other groups, creating in-groups and out-groups. Generally speaking, our families are in-groups, and perhaps our neighborhoods. People across town or in other neighborhoods might be out-groups, but that can change if a local or regional sports team is on a winning streak and we're all behind them together. However, some demarcations between and out have become cemented in our society's collective psyche. Race, gender, immigration status, economic class, and sexuality. Add to that the concept of privilege, and certain identities and groups are inherently favored. Recently, my book club read Killers of the Flower Moon by David Gran, a nonfiction account of a grim episode in American history that hadn't made it into the history books that most of us studied back in the day. In the 1870s, the Osage Indians were once again driven off the reservation that had been set aside for them in Kansas and resettled in a rocky, barren territory in northeast Oklahoma. And at the same time, the tribal families were actually assigned their own individual plots, while the tribe retained mineral rights. Lo and behold, several decades later, oil was discovered on the reservation. And in no time, the Indians were receiving large royalties from those mineral rights. They built big houses and bought fancy cars and even had servants. At one point, the Osage had the highest per capita income in the world. So, do you think their white neighbors stood by and cheered at the good fortune of the Osage? No. In 1921, a strange series of deaths among the Osage caused alarm within the tribe. Some were shot, some poisoned. One family was blown up in its home. The local authorities could find no clues. But that was because of an amazingly broad and deep conspiracy among the leaders of the white community to get their hands on reservation property after the deaths of the owners. After all, these people of privilege believed the Osage were too ignorant and too lazy to manage their own affairs. How the whole situation was resolved is another story for another time. How different is this anecdote from current white attitudes about the intelligence and ambition of blacks? And then this becomes the core of prejudice and discrimination. Not only are groups guilty of attribution errors, we all personally share that guilt. When we hear bitter words or hateful stories from an individual, how often do we assume that the words and the stories represent the essence of that individual, who must therefore be demeaning and cruel to his or her family or coworkers? How shocked are we to find that the person is basically kind and charitable? It doesn't fit with our own biases. This problem of heightened rudeness has been exacerbated by the internet. There is something about the anonymity of the internet that loosens the old rules of civility and lets our demons out. One alternative is to avoid returning rudeness for rudeness, to startle the hate monger with kind words, to find a topic which gets beyond the hate and reveals the truly human being on the other end. So what is the opposite of hate? We know that hate and love are not opposites. The opposite of love is indifference. What is the opposite of hate? Hate is something that creates barriers. So the opposite is connection. Finding some way, some topic through which you can shift hateful discourse into something constructive. Ms. Cohn goes beyond the confines of the internet. She describes the life and the conversion of a Palestinian terrorist caught up in the ongoing conflict between the former occupants of the West Bank and Israel. As a child, he and his family lived in a cave on the outskirts of Hebron. He recalls his first encounter with Israeli soldiers when he was 5, after which they were a constant presence in his community. He witnessed a young girl shot and killed, then a teenage boy. He learned to hate the Israeli soldiers. Here are opposing groups that each consider themselves victims. Its problems the result of the other group. There are plenty of other examples of this dual victimhood. Think of the decades of trouble in Northern Ireland, or the Bosnian genocide committed by the Serbs. As a teen, Bassam, the Palestinian, formed a gang with 4 of his friends and harassed the Israeli soldiers. At 17, he was arrested and sent to prison for 7 years. At first, he would indulge in hateful fantasies, but then he got to see a film about the Holocaust. The magnitude and the brutality shocked him and broke through the story of hate he had come to believe. He got to know an Israeli guard and asked him questions about Israel and religion and life in general. After he was released, Bassam went to graduate school and got a master's degree in Holocaust studies. Ultimately, he worked together with Israelis to form a group called Combatants for Peace, which facilitates public performances and conversations, providing connections, opportunities to be in the same place, to talk, and experience each other's humanity. Although Bassam still supports the Palestinian cause, and on the other side the Israelis support their cause, he has consciously and deliberately rejected hate. Coretta Scott King once said, "Hate is too great a burden to bear. It injures the hater more than it injures the hated." From my own experience, I know how corrosive and exhausting hate is. The opposite of hate isn't some mushy middle zone of dispassionate centrism. You can still have strong beliefs and still treat others whose beliefs are quite the opposite of yours with civility and respect. Last Tuesday, I had the opportunity to attend the monthly meeting of CAMA, the Cadillac Area Ministerial Association. It was a particularly festive meeting. At least 20 ministers and folks like me around a long table bidding farewell to Mark and Valerie Nance of the Salvation Army, to Dave McMahon, now retired from a long and fruitful pastorate at the First Baptist Church, and to Paul Tomlinson, who was on the verge of retirement from the First Presbyterian Church, as well as a new marriage and a new life in Las Vegas. That'll be quite a shift from Cadillac, won't it? There were many messages of fond memories and good wishes, and then Dave McMahon pointed out what a special and unusual group CAMA is, one that doesn't exist in very many communities. It has been in existence since 1955 and does all kinds of things, such as support the chaplain at the hospital. And it presently runs the gamut from the Revival Center, the Northern Light Ministry, two churches of the Nazarene, the Salvation Army, to the United Methodist Church, Zion Lutheran Church, First Presbyterian Church, First Congregational UCC, St. Mary's Episcopal Church, and even St. Anne's Roman Catholic Church, represented by Phil Potvin, and many others. It is a collegial group of widely divergent viewpoints, where the key factors are respect and support. Connection takes place there. Connection is not an easy choice. In fact, the world seems rigged against it. Our tendency toward tribalism makes us quick to latch on to society's existing prejudices and to further burrow into historical habits of hate. We have to change not only our own hearts and minds, but the institutions, practices, systems, and culture all around us. The first step is challenging the hate inside ourselves. We need to become more conscious of our own hate in all its forms and work to catch and challenge our ideas and our assumptions. At the same time, if we want to stop the hate in our societies, we must support policies and institutions that bring us together rather than divide us. And when we make the decision to connect, when we come together in connection spaces facilitated by connection systems, we also need to talk to each other differently. With a generosity and open-mindedness and kindness and compassion of connection speech. Now, Sally Cohn speaks from a decidedly secular point of view. That doesn't discount her ideas, but it does give us an advantage. We have a long tradition of a Christ-centered example to follow. We can constantly refer to the words and the examples of someone who did not exclude the outgroups, who kept a careful, even critical eye on the people of privilege, who explained to us exactly who our neighbor is and showed us by example exactly how to treat him. Let us never lose sight of Christ's example and be thankful for it every day. Most holy and gracious God, grant that we may put aside hatred and prejudice and open our hearts to the good and the beauty all around us, and return love for love. Amen.